The Triathlon Show 383. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, we have two expert interviews related to the usage of carbon fiber-plated shoes, or so-called super shoes. First, Dr. Dustin Joubert, who has been on the podcast before, discusses new research on the effect that super shoes have at slower speeds that are more relevant for the majority of runners and triathletes, and how these effects and the improvements in running economy differ from the previously observed effects at faster speeds. Then in the second interview, Dr. Amol Saxena shares a case series of how rapidly transitioning to running in super shoes may increase the risk of navicular bone stress injuries. Each of these interviews is about 30 minutes long, but I will come back after the first one and introduce the second one. So there will be a small interlude there. But before we get into listening to these interviews, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training through a display on the goggle lens. You can see every split, live stroke rate, and even live heart rate if you use polar heart rate monitors. And all of this will help you execute your swim workouts more optimally with better pacing and better control of your intensity. You can also get access to in-depth post-swim analysis with additional metrics in the Form app. And the app syncs your workouts seamlessly to Training Peaks, Strava, Today's Plan, and Final Surge. They also have a vast library of workouts and training plans that you can use, or you can build your own guided workouts. Get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Now let's get into the first interview with Dr. Dustin Joubert about whether super shoes are still effective, even at slower running speeds than those previously studied. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Dustin. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Michael. Good to be here again.
Yeah, it's very nice to have you back. For the listeners that may not have heard your previous appearance on the podcast, can you give us a brief introduction to yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm an exercise physiologist, university faculty. I'm currently at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. Been here just for about a year now, previously over at Stephen F. Austin State University, where I've done some of my previous work. And, you know, I'm a long-time runner, always had an interest in endurance exercise performance. And with, you know, the new shoes that are out now, that's been a fun line of research for me for the last couple of years.
So I have to ask, what's your next big running goal then, since you are a runner?
I've got Boston next month, yeah.
All right, yeah. So some putting in some good long runs now. And what will be your racing shoe for Boston?
We're going Alpha Fly, original Alpha Fly, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Well, in that original interview, we discussed your first study comparing a number of the different carbon plated fiber footwear that was out there, including the original Alpha Fly. And I think then already you mentioned that you had something in the works to investigate whether the running economy benefits that you have seen and others have seen as well in the super shoes translate to slower speeds where most runners perform, especially if we're talking something long like the marathon. And that's something that has now been published. So can you talk a bit more about this more recently published study that you did?
Yeah. So I think, you know, after we did that first study, we had tested at 16 kilometers per hour in that study, which is pretty common from some of the other research that was in the lit prior to on the new shoes. And I think a lot of the questions that people had, you know, people, that's 16 kilometers per hour is like in the 238-ish marathon range, right?
It should be. Yeah, right around there.
Yeah, too. And even the slower speeds at the time that had been tested in the lit was 14 kilometers per hour, which is a 3-hour marathon. And, you know, you've got a lot of people running marathons at slower paces than that, even at big you know, races where you need a qualifying time for. Majority of people at a Boston race or something like that are running slower. And then, you know, in the triathlon world, running slower paces off the bike, we started to ask the question of like, you know, are the benefits still this like 3-ish, 4-ish% that we had seen in the faster speeds? And so we got 16 subjects for this most recent study to test at both 10 and 12 kilometers per hour, which that's looking for the marathon. That's more like 330 to 415 marathoners would be relevant to.
Yeah. And this was a pace that for these runners were basically a pretty sustainable pace, right? That would have been around their marathon pace or so.
Yeah. So with like all the running economy research, you have to test at like slower than their lactate threshold, because when you get more in that like heavy intensity exercise domain, you might not reach steady state oxygen consumption within like the 5-minute window or so that we were measuring respiratory gas exchange. And so, you know, I think our inclusion criteria in order to test people at 12 kilometers per hour, which is basically 8-minute mile pace, or is that five minute per kilometer pace, we needed people who were like probably capable of running like 23:30 for 5K. So that was like the initial inclusion criteria. I think we've recruited probably people that were a little bit faster than that. Like on the men's side, they're probably more, well, we have lifetime best that we listed in the paper. So more like 19 minutes to 21-ish minutes probably between the men and the women. But it was definitely a slower group than like, we didn't take all the people who were, you know, 235 marathoners from the previous study and bring them into this study. There were people who are, those paces were relevant too, but they have to be fast enough to run at those paces at a steady state aerobic intensity.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you say lactate threshold, they're to be below lactate threshold. We're talking about the first lactate threshold, right? So they would be in the moderate intensity domain or?
Yeah. Well, so kind of two things we look at as a check at the end of the test to make sure they're below 4 millimoles is like one of our safeguards. And then, so we're not actually bringing them in for like threshold testing prior, but based on their performance times being below, you know, 23:30, we'd estimate at this pace they'd be fine. So we like double check that and make sure they're below 4 millimoles lactate. But probably more importantly, you can see that they're, this is kind of getting into the physiology details more, but you can see their respiratory exchange ratios are below 1 if you're going to try to use that for a caloric expenditure estimation. And then you can just visualize oxygen consumption to see that they're reaching a steady state in that 5-minute like window that we're measuring oxygen consumption. So there's a number of ways to ensure that. Yeah. But.
Got it. And then, yeah, in terms of the testing protocol that you used, and importantly, the shoes, what shoes did you test here and what was the specific protocol used?
Yeah. So kind of as a starting point on assessing the shoes at slower speeds, we just went with the most tested shoe out there, which has been the Nike Vaporfly line. So the shoe we've got is the Vaporfly Next Percent 2. But that's the most studied shoe in the super shoe lit. So it made sense to go with one that we knew worked well at faster speeds to investigate at slower speeds. So that was our experimental shoe, and then our control shoe that we've been using. That's just like standard EVA foam, no plate, similar mass was the ASICS Hyperspeed. That's what we've been using.
And then the protocol was also similar to what you have been using in previous studies. Can you describe that?
Yeah, so standard running economy protocol is 5-minute stages or 5-minute trials. And you ideally want to test each shoe in duplicate all within the same day to limit the variability of like your equipment and your person. So to test the shoe at 10 kilometers per hour, those two shoes, we would do 4 by 5-minute reps at 10 kilometers per hour with 5-minute breaks between each rep. And we would test the shoes in like a BBA sequence or a BAA sequence. So you do the control shoe, experimental shoe, experimental shoe, control shoe. So you kind of eliminate any sequence effect and you test each shoe in duplicate. So given that we were only testing two shoes and two speeds, we were able to do like all 8 trials. So the four trials per speed, all 8 trials in the same day, which is nice from a getting the study done perspective and getting people in and out, but also limiting the variability that you would see otherwise between days.
Yeah, yeah. Just to make sure that the listeners are we're following along there. So it's 8 trials total because you have 2 shoes, the control and the Vaporfly shoe, and you have two tests with each shoe at each speed, so 10 kilometers an hour and 12 kilometers an hour, or that is 5 and 6 minutes per kilometer pace, or 8 and what is 10 kilometers per hour? Or
940.
940, yeah. 940 mile pace. All right, so what were the results then?
Yeah, so, you know, in the previous study we had done, we had seen the Vaporfly compared to that same control shoe at 16 kilometers per hour and those faster runners at about 2.7% economy benefit, which is consistent with what you see in the rest of the lit, kind of ranging from 2.7 to 4% and the other studies that have been done on that shoe. In this study, using that same shoe and control shoe at the 12 kilometers per hour speed, we only saw a benefit of around like 1.5%. So slightly reduced compared to the faster speeds. And then even more so at the 10 kilometers per hour, a little less than 1% benefit. So the benefits in terms of economy were reduced at these slower speeds.
Yeah. And why do you think that that is? Do you have any hypothesis for that? I mean, the slower speed for something that was already, but what is the reason for that at slower speeds you might have reduced benefits?
Yeah. So in the paper, we kind of hypothesized two mechanisms. My main thought going in was sort of like how much you're compressing the foam is probably relevant. So these new, like, highly compliant and resilient foams made of PIBA and this like ZoomX foam in these shoes. We know those the material properties are a big advancement, but you know, the foam is only returning energy that you put into it. And so running at slower speeds, lower ground reaction forces, you're putting less energy into the shoe with each step. And so you only can get back what you put in. So that's one of our hypotheses, is that maybe that you're just compressing the foam less at these lower speeds and capitalizing less on the benefits of it. It's also possible that like the control shoe that's using that standard EVA foam maybe is like not as much of a detriment at slower speeds, because like that foam is good enough at the lower forces that are being put into it. So it's maybe it's a combination of those things. And you know, there's some other research with these stiff carbon plates that are embedded into the shoes that increase longitudinal bending stiffness, may be more beneficial at faster speeds. Some of the research on the just carbon plates alone, regardless of the new foams, is a little more equivocal, but maybe some suggestions that plate, that stiffness, you need to be running at faster speeds to sort of flex that plate.
Yeah. In the paper, you have a graph with all the individual responses, and you've looked at that as well and commented on it. So there were actually a few subjects that had lower running economy with the Vaporfly as compared with the control shoe. More so, I think 5 subjects at 10 kilometers an hour had actually a lower running economy, and only 2 of them at 12 kilometers an hour. Now, I can't remember off the top of my head, but is this something that you have seen at the 16 kilometer per hour speeds at all, with some individuals having reduced running economy in the Vaporfly as compared to the control shoe?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a point that people are starting to pay more attention to is in the previous lit. So in our study where we tested at 16 kilometers per hour, if you look at the Barnes paper and the Hokomer paper where they tested at faster speeds, every single there's a range in like responses in terms of the magnitude of the benefits people get in this shoe, but everyone had a beneficial response. And so that's across, you know, 3 studies, probably 36 subjects there. And if you look in our study, as you mentioned, at the slowest speed at that 10 kilometers per hour, 5 of our 16 subjects actually had a decrement in economy in this Vaporfly shoe. So that is novel. That is different than what we've seen previously. And then, as you said, two of the subjects at the 12 kilometer per hour speed. But so, yeah, I think that's definitely a point for people running at slower paces who are like, oh, I need to go put on one of these super shoes. You know, our group average data shows that there's still a benefit probably across this like whole group with this shoe at slower speeds, but there's a chance that you're one of these people who actually has a negative response, and your economy gets worse. And so that'd be certainly a concern.
Yeah. And you did weight match the shoes, so you added some weights, I think, to one of the shoes, but I can't remember, was it the control shoe you added weights to, or the Vaporfly shoe, which one was lighter to start with?
The control shoe is like, we added weight, the Vaporfly is a little lighter, so we added like, it's like 13 grams. It's like a few wing nuts that you put on the laces.
Yeah, okay.
So
yeah, the Vaporfly is lighter, you said, and so that's
right.
Okay, yeah. So maybe one of those subjects ends up having a neutral response, let's say, if it's actually at its. But then you could find another control shoe that is maybe lighter than the Vaporfly.
Yeah, it depends on what the person's like. You know, the Vaporfly is the Vaporfly, but people have a bunch of other options. If they were saying like, I'm going to run in some standard shoe that I just like, it might be more heavy than that. And
yeah. Yeah.
On race day, you don't mass match things, but in certain laboratory experiments, it makes sense to mass match things. In this study, I thought it did. In our previous study, where we were just comparing all the different super shoes on the market to one another, it didn't make sense to mass match things there because you're going to compete in that shoe as is. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and one thing that we talked about in our last interview about maybe there is a reason for individuals, at least if you are looking to gain a minute or a few minutes in your marathon, to then we talked about comparing some of the best super shoes for the individual response. Are you running faster in the Vaporflies or the Alphaflies or the Asics or Adidas or whichever shoes you might prefer? But here you could even say that, well, maybe if somebody's looking to break 4 hours for the marathon, maybe it is and they are just on the cusp of doing it, maybe it is beneficial to test just your regular favorite shoe with a super shoe, just to make sure that you're not just choosing the shoe because it has a heavier price tag and heavier marketing behind it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it just like the blanket assumption that shoe is going to help you. You know, I think what's the practical advice to people is like, you know, if you run in the Vaporfly, even at these slower speeds and you feel like it's like decreasing your effort, and it doesn't feel clumsy and uncomfortable and you can, you know, wear it for the distance that you need to wear it for, then maybe you're not one of those non-responders. Maybe you're not one of those negative responders and you can be more confident that you're probably getting a benefit out of it. Right. But if you put it on and are like, I don't know, this thing kind of feels wonky, I feel a lot more comfortable in my other shoe for long durations. Then I think those are the people that you probably shouldn't just assume that new super shoe is helping you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to run something by you here because I actually, a few months ago, I went into the lab to test a few different super shoes and a control shoe myself. And I kind of followed your protocol with 5 minute stages and then looking at the economy at the end of each stage with 5 minute rest in between the stages as well. So, but then what I saw there was that the running economy correlated very well with my heart rate as well. So the heart rate differences were not big, but you know, I could see a 1 to 2 beat per minute, very clear and stable difference between the shoe that also had, where I had lower oxygen consumption or higher oxygen consumption. So my theory then was that, well, if I don't want to go into the lab next time I'm doing something like this, or if I don't have access to a lab, I could just do a controlled experiment like that on the treadmill and just look at heart rate as a proxy for oxygen consumption. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and so that's a common question, is like, how do I do this testing if I don't have a metabolic cart or a lab with one, right? And I don't, heart rate is not a terrible like physiological marker as an indice of like, you know, the effort that's required in these different shoes. It's the one thing with heart rate is it's a little noisier of a signal than like a VO2 on a good metabolic cart. VO2 on a good metabolic cart is like a lot tighter, a lot less variation. And then heart rate, in my experience, like even in a temperature controlled room, heart rate still tends to drift up a little bit more across the sequence. So it's probably, you know, the way that we test like in a random order and then a mirrored sequence, doing that mirrored sequence so that you're testing the shoes in duplicate and it's not just like your later reps that maybe if heart rate starts to drift more that you're picking that up. So I think that probably becomes even more important with heart rate. And then if you look at our data, you know, the conclusions we made in like the super shoe study where we're comparing, you know, 8 different shoes, because the variability in the metabolic cards like so low, you're able to make like conclusive statements or statistical conclusions easier there. The heart rate differences do exist like across the broad range of shoes, but it's harder to be like, okay, this mid-tier shoe compared to this top-tier shoe, like on heart rate alone. So it's when you have like closer, more subtle differences between the shoes that heart rate's a little bit harder to make conclusions on than VO2. But if if you're looking at like a control shoe versus a shoe that's giving you 4% economy benefit, I would bet heart rate's going to be fine in showing you that too. But it's one of, where there's more of the smaller differences where I've seen in our data that it'd be harder to make those conclusions.
Okay. Well, those are great points. One thing that you mentioned in the discussion part of the paper is about a study about markers of muscle damage when using these carbon plated shoes. And so that's not a study that you did or your colleagues, I think, but another group. But what you mentioned there, I think I found interesting that theoretically, even if running economy might not be, you might not get as big benefits when you're running at slower speeds. If you're out there for a long time and based on this other study that showed some decreased markers of muscle damage when using these super shoes, then that could also be a potential mechanism for helping performance in long events like the marathon.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the like areas of future research that needs to be expanded is the, you know, the anecdotal evidence of these shoes, what people will say, save your legs or like, you know, cause less muscle damage. That anecdotal evidence is really strong, right? And like probably in both of our own personal experiences at the end of long runs, our legs feel fresher or we're not as sore the next day, or my calves aren't as sore after a hard session or something. So like, I definitely think there's something there. If you look at the limited amount of research that's out there, there was one like conference symposium proceeding abstract from the Nike research group. And it's really, you know, small sample of like between subject comparisons of people who had run in the Nike Pegasus, like standard trainer versus the, I think the Vaporfly, whatever iteration it was at the time, and the Portland Marathon. And the group who had worn the Vaporfly had less like blood markers and muscle damage. So it, you know, scarce evidence, but would probably match with what a lot of people's like personal experiences are. And then, you know, the other study that's out more recently, that's a full blown publication in MSSE was, from Matthew Black, in Andy Jones's lab at Exeter. And they actually did biopsy work and all the, like the blood markers, in the, I think the shoe was the Alphafly Next Percent 2. They didn't name it. They say unnamed prototype, but they compared that to a control shoe and they did damaging exercise. It's a little unconventional. They did laboratory damaging running exercise. They did this downhill running protocol. And then they looked like 48 hours post at markers of muscle damage. They didn't see any differences, but I think maybe it was the design they used. So I think more needs to be like parsed out there on like making a conclusive statement on, you know, the extent of muscle damage in these new shoes versus a standard shoe. But yeah, to all that, to go back to your original idea of like, even if the economy benefit is small, if you have less muscle damage late in the race and so you're not cramping, well, certainly you're going to maintain pace better, right? And then the other thing that interests me, even on the economy front, is if we could measure economy late after like a long duration session or a long bout of damaging exercise, measure economy, not when your legs are fresh like our typical protocols do, but do it at the end of like an hour, 2 hour run. Maybe those differences become like more disparate or wide. But in that Black study, they attempted to do that, but they caused basically the same amount of muscle damage. And then when they did the economy like follow-up testing on damaged muscle, it was 48 hours later, like during that DOMS period. It wasn't like at the end of the 2 hour session kind of thing. So yeah, I think there's more to be seen there, but yeah, I think if you're still comfortable in the shoe 2 hours in and it caused less muscle damage, then I bet there's going to be benefits beyond just the acute fresh leg economy data.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point about measuring economy late in a long run. That's something that is done a lot now in cycling research, but arguably the changes are probably going to be more significant in running because there's a larger variability between runners in running economy compared to in gross efficiency in cycling. So So yeah, that would be really interesting, and hopefully we can see something like that in the future. So if you summarize, or if you what would you say is the summary or the take home message from this recent work to just leave it at with the listeners?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're running at slower speeds, like the speeds we tested at, probably on average, you're still going to get a benefit from from this super shoe that we tested, the Vaporfly. But blanket assumption shouldn't be that everyone is going to get a positive benefit. So you probably need to take into account like how the shoe feels, how it feels over longer durations, to really know that.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about yet, but we talked about that in the previous episode, is that depending on your speed, running economy is going to translate to performance improvement differently, right? So if you're running at very high speeds, a 4% economy improvement is different than at slower speeds, and the relationship there is going to be closer to a 1-to-1 ratio if you're running at slow speeds. So the 1.5% that you might get at 12 kilometers an hour might actually mean the same as, I don't know, 2-2.5% at 16 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Is the translating the economy benefit to a velocity improvement is more of a 1-to-1 like percentage comparison at slower speeds. So, you know, but still the reduction in economy benefit that we saw here was like marked enough to where the overall time benefits are going to be reduced too. So I think, you know, if you're looking at the 1.5% economy benefit, that's going to be for the 12 kilometer per hour we tested at. So for like your 330 marathoner, that 1.5% economy benefit maybe translates to like 3 minutes marathon time improvement, which is certainly substantial still.
Yeah. And then just finally, so another thing that many listeners will be aware of is your work with LabRat Rundown. When last we spoke, you only had the Instagram account. Now you have a nice website as well, where you do a lot of, well, you summarize the research, but you also do a bunch of N=1 case studies and different interesting work related to shoes. So is there anything anything really cool that you got going on there or have done in the last few months that you would like to highlight so that listeners can go and have a look in more detail?
Yeah, definitely. So I can share some stuff on some recent university research as well as like the kind of lab rat stuff, that spinoff stuff I've shared. But one other thought kind of in closing, in the study we've been talking about, you know, if there was one other sort of caveat in the individual responsiveness, we tested our like average weight or mass of our subjects was, there was only like two people over 70 kilograms in our cohort of the 8 men and 8 women that we tested. And so if we go back to like this theory of maybe like you're not compressing the foam as much, or not flexing the plate as much, that's dependent on ground reaction forces, which speed is a big component of that, but body mass would be a component of that too. So you definitely have people who are, you know, running 3-34 hour marathons that weigh a lot more than 70 kilograms. And so it would be interesting to see if we looked in like a heavier population running at those same speeds, if that hypothesis on the foam being relevant and ground reaction force being relevant, if they potentially got more benefit. So I think that would be one caveat I'd give for more study results. But yeah, so on the lab rat stuff, we just wrapped up another university project. We just wrapped up looking at the benefits of super spikes. So we have the Dragonfly, the Avanti from Adidas, and a control spike compared, looking at like quantifying the benefits of the spikes, but also compared to shoes to see like, are people's economies better in the spikes versus the shoes, which is not relevant necessarily internationally, but in the US where you can wear whatever you want on a track at like NCAA and high school level, shoes versus spikes is a relevant comparison. So we've got some results on that, coming out, since we talked last. I mean, there's a bunch of case study stuff that's up on that Instagram page. The website kind of mirrors the Instagram page, but not everyone uses Instagram. And Instagram, like once you have a bunch of posts on there, kind of like it's hard to catalog things or, you know, find things. So that was the goal with the website, was kind of just to have everything in a more searchable space. So yeah, it's labratrundown.com. I've got some other university projects coming up. We're doing a, you know, most of the research on these shoes has been in on a treadmill in a laboratory setting. We're going to do some road testing, actually on like concrete road surfaces with a portable metabolic cart. So that's, we'll hopefully be starting that here and within the next month or so. And then down the line, I don't know, I see our original like super shoe study just to kind of like assess the state of the market, like were there differences across brands and models? And there certainly were in that first study. But I think as companies come out with new iterations of shoes and are improving the foams in their shoes, I think that was probably one of the big differences initially. Hopefully within the next year or so, we'll like kind of do another assessment of the market. Super shoe study 2.0, which, you know, ideally you see things that the playing field get leveled. That would be like probably good for all stakeholders. Well, maybe not individual shoe companies, but the rest of the stakeholders, that would be a good thing. So yeah. I don't know. I could talk more specifics if you had anything and if you wanted more specifics on.
I think that's a cool, that's a good summary. And yeah, I would just encourage listeners to go and have a look at the website or the Instagram account. There's a lot of interesting things there. I think one of the interesting posts that I remember was when you summarized the one research article on how running uphill and running downhill, how the running economy benefits are different compared to flat ground running. And then of course you have all of your just individual case studies where you compare different shoes that haven't been tested in the literature. So there's lots of things to go and dig into if you're interested in shoes.
If there's any new shoe publication that comes out, I try to summarize it to kind of like, whether it's my research or others, just to translate it to the general population has been one of the goals with that. So.
Yeah. All right. So let's do some rapid fire questions. So this is rapid fire questions V2, because you already answered the previous ones. And the first one is, what's your favorite place to train?
Oh, my favorite place to train. So I moved to Austin, Texas a year ago. And Austin, Texas is a great place to train. It's got a great running community. Shout out to the Purple Dragons long run crew down here. They've been getting me through my Boston build-up miles. So probably not the most scenic place in the world, but it's been a great running community for me for long run work, especially.
That's good. And what's a bucket list race or event that you would want to do?
I left my triathlon racing, I don't know, probably 7-8 years ago. Kona would always be kind of a bucket list thing. Maybe when I'm in my 40s here soon and the kid's older and I can, you know, give up weekends to training like that again. But World Marathon Major is appealing right now. I really want to run New York. New York looks fun every time I watch it on TV. So
yeah. The only thing with New York is that the time that you have to wait there in the starting corral seems horrible from what I've heard. Really? Yeah. I don't know. It just, and it can be quite cold there from what I've heard. So, finally, if you could acquire expert level in any skill in the world for yourself in an instant, what would it be?
Practical answer for my current job would be to be an expert biomechanist, because I'm a physiologist, not a biomechanist. So that would be nice for some of the research that I'm doing, but that's not very fun. That's kind of boring. So I don't know. I feel like the lifestyle of like a professional football player or something would be much better than being like an elite runner. But
yeah. That would be interesting, very different from a normal person's life for sure. Well, thank you so much, Dustin, for your time and for sharing your research. It's been great. I'll link to your website and Instagram in the show notes so people can go and have a look at that. And I've enjoyed it as always, and hope to talk to you again another time.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
I hope that you found that interesting. I think that it's super relevant research for the vast majority of runners and triathletes who will be running at slower speeds than those 14 to 16 kilometers an hour that have been tested before. Now, it's possible for runners in these new ranges of speed studied, so 10 to 12 kilometers an hour, to make informed decisions on whether the running economy gains and the theoretical performance gains based on that, whether that warrants investing in these types of shoes. It's still important to point out that not all super shoes are created equal, and that's what we talked about in the original interview with Dr. Joubert, where we discussed his study comparing seven different super shoes. And while some of these shoes, like the Nike Vaporflies of that generation, performed great, others were no better than a non-carbon control shoe. So again, in this particular study, the Nike Vaporflies was the model tested. So we don't know what this means for how another brands or another model of super shoes will perform. It is specific to the Nike Vaporflies, of course. If you're interested in hearing more about the differences between various super shoes, then definitely go and listen to episode 322 with Dustin Joubert, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Right, so let's move on to the interview with Dr. Amol Saxena. Before the interview, I do want to point out that this is a case series, so it does not imply a causal relationship between using super shoes and getting injured. But a case series is a good and tool to raise early awareness of something. So in this case, the potential risk of injury when transitioning to running in super shoes. But the point here is simply this is not raising the alarm or anything like that. It's simply flagging an area, I guess, where some people might need to have some awareness and caution about how they transition into running with super shoes. I hope that all makes sense, but I'm sure Dr. Amol Saxena explained that much more eloquently than I did. So let's just jump into the interview. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Amol. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. Before we get into the main topic, can you just give us an introduction? Tell us a bit more about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a podiatrist in Palo Alto, California, specializing in sports medicine. I've been in practice about a third of a century. I've treated about 100 Olympians, operated on 3 Olympic gold medalists, and I've published about 150 articles on foot and ankle related issues. And I'm keenly interested in helping athletes, particularly endurance athletes, track and field athletes, get back to the sports they like doing.
Yeah, that's quite the resume. The reason that we're talking today is a recent article that you wrote on the potential risk of navicular bone stress injuries in relation to using carbon fiber plated shoes. So can you explain how that came about, first of all, finding or having the hypothesis for that relation and then writing the article itself?
Yeah, so the world is small, and I've been lucky to meet a lot of interesting people. I've traveled around, and I have had an interest in navicular stress fractures. I published an article in 2000 about a navicular stress fracture pattern and came up with a classification that seems correlated with outcome. And that by that I mean is how bad your navicular stress fracture will predict how long it'll take you to get back to sport or whether you need surgery. And so I'm fairly well known. The classification is actually called the Saxena classification. And we share info with other doctors, and sometimes doctors contact me for advice about treating these injuries. And we had some similar findings. I explained that I had a couple, more than a couple navicular injuries, and it was in the carbon fiber shoes. And they're fairly dramatic or acute. And navicular injuries are slow to get diagnosed. I had a paper in 2017 on the biggest series of surgery on athletes, and they often take about 8+ months, almost 9 months to diagnose. So they're difficult to pick up. So doctors are are interested in trying to figure out why people have vague ankle or midfoot pain. And so I shared my conversations with Dr. 1040, who then in turn shared his conversations with Dr. Hollander, and he's in contact with Tim Honig. And so we found some similarities of midfoot injuries. With this paper, we decided just to concentrate just for more scientific value on navicular injuries itself. I've seen other midfoot injuries with these shoes that seem atypical, I'd say. Some other stress fractures in the metatarsals that are slow to heal, and in the other midfoot bones that are not so slow to heal, as well as plantar fascia ruptures and posterior tibial tendon ruptures have been noticed in the carbon fiber shoes. And this has been primarily the first athletes, actually. So
yeah, let's maybe start with defining the navicular injuries. So what is that? Is that particular bone or several bones in the midfoot for the listeners that are not familiar? Can you explain?
Yeah, yeah. So the navicular bone is the arch bone. So on the high point of your foot is your arch, and the highest point is usually the navicular, which is just beyond your ankle bone or your talus. And it gets a lot of undue stress, and sometimes undue stress ends up in a bone stress injury. And a stress fracture is kind of a little bit difficult term to really relate, because if you jump off a bench 10 times and then get an MRI, you'll show stress to your knee and to your midfoot. And so that's why we try to call these bone stress injuries, because they're an actual injury, not just stress. And then with my classification system, we try to classify them to show how bad they are, which in turn determines the treatment and how long it'll take to get better.
What would the symptoms be like? You mentioned that they're often quite acute, these injuries. So how would one know or suspect that one has a navicular bone stress injury?
Well, they're often acute, but not as often as you think.
Okay.
I had one back when I was in podiatry school almost 40 years ago. It came on very acutely. It felt like someone took a chisel and just into the top of my foot. And the two cases I provided in the series were very acute. The issue is that some people have a quick, rapid, acute pain, and then it just kind of calms down, because the navicular bone, the reason why these are such important injuries and potentially career-ending injuries, is that the bone does not have good blood supply. That one bone is one of the three or four bones in the foot that have high risk and slow healing. So this is why it takes often long time to heal, because it doesn't have good blood supply. And because it doesn't have good blood supply, this is why the bruising and swelling that you see with other fractures in the foot doesn't occur. And so many people might just brush it off and just say, oh, your arch hurts. You might have arch pain or ankle sprain pain. And this is why it often takes 8 or 9 months to diagnose. So it's important to know about this, because the sports medicine docs need to have a high index of suspicion. So if it hurts on top of your foot, we call it the N spot, N for navicular. And if it throbs and aches, hurts to jump up and down on your toes, particularly barefoot. Patients often say, I can run 70 miles a week, but when I do speed work, it really hurts after I'm limping. Those are people that are giving symptoms potentially of a navicular stress fracture.
And I think you had a stat in the article saying that navicular stress fractures or stress injuries might be, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you said 35-37% of all stress fractures, so a fairly high number.
In athletes in the foot, correct, yeah.
Okay, so it's only in the foot. Okay, gotcha.
Not of all. They're still relatively rare. I mean, my series in 2017 was 63, I believe, and that was the biggest series, particularly the biggest series of people who've had surgery for the navicular, so.
Right, yeah. If you have a navicular stress injury, what is the treatment and rehabilitation process like?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So first, you got to understand you've got a serious injury, and it can take minimum 3 months to get better based on the classifications that the original ones, which are type 1, which is a crack in the top of the navicular bone. Type 2 is a crack from the top extending into the bone, can be like halfway through. And then type 3 is a complete fracture through the bone. And in, I believe in 2006, we came up with a type 0.5, which is not quite broken, but it's a bone stress injury. So it doesn't show up as broken on a CT scan, which, by the way, is the best treatment or best diagnostic test is a CT scan with small cuts because the MRI misses stress fractures oftentimes. It doesn't show fracture detail. So if you have a navicular injury, you really should get a CT scan. And then the treatment is for the type 0.5, which does not show any fracture at all based on a CT scan. And type 1 is generally non-surgical, non-weight-bearing for 3 to 6 weeks, boot, keeping their foot at 90 degrees. That's the problem. People just use crutches and their foot hangs down. If their foot hangs down, they have tension on top of their foot. Bones do not heal with tension on top of their foot. So they need to be in a boot at 90 degrees and non-weight-bearing minimum. Usually for type 1s, it's going to be 6 weeks, and then you walk in a boot for another 4 weeks. And get back to activity. For type 2, which is the partial fracture, and type 3, complete fracture, keep in mind, a lot of doctors think, oh, this is a non-displaced fracture. It doesn't need surgery. This is wrong in this injury. If you have a type 2 or type 3 fracture, in my study in 2017, your bone will either not heal, re-break, or go on to having arthritis in the joint. And that was the situation. It's public knowledge with Paula Radcliffe. There's an article that she's quoted about. And so these are three bad things that can happen to an athlete that wants to run. And so the treatment for those would be surgery and sometimes some bone graft if it's an older injury and you just use bone graft from the heel. And so with surgery, you have a screw to compress the fracture, usually one screw. Sometimes we have two in bigger athletes like basketball players. And can't really say the prevalence because we don't have a registry or a data bank for navicular injuries. I sort of become the data bank for a lot of colleagues who send me their cases, but we don't have a registry. And if you're low in vitamin D, you're more likely not to heal. The other treatment that's exciting for us is something called shockwave. It's been around for 20 years. There's three different types of shockwaves now. There's focused shockwave, which is better for bone. So we use that for navicular injuries. There's a newer type of shockwave called electromagnetic transduction therapy, which is abbreviated EMTT. And those two shockwaves are game changers. We used that in one of the athletes in the series, and he healed very quickly, was able to do his marathon 4 weeks later because he had a type 0.5. So shockwave is definitely an excellent treatment and oftentimes a adjunctive or an addition to surgery.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Just one follow-up on that. If you have a surgery for it with a type 2 or type 3, how long would you normally expect until you can start running again after surgery?
Yeah, it's usually about 4.5 months. And about 10% of the people can have a refraction, and about 10% of the people can need the screw removed. Most of the time we leave the screw in. You can look on my website. I've had several elite athletes very well-known triathletes, including Jesse Thomas, that have screws in both his feet. So,
So what is the connection between carbon fiber shoes and navicular stress injuries?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The carbon fiber plate bends very little, and it's curved. If you look at the picture we have in our article, there's an x-ray of a side view of a lead athlete and where the plate lies in relation to his bones. your bones are lined up to have hinges, or your foot is lined up to have hinges. There's 33 joints. There's actually 28 bones, even though they say 26. There are two bones underneath the big toe called sesamoids, which are also slow healing stress fractures, by the way. So your bones and your feet will bend where they line up, and the carbon fiber plate won't bend. So if your carbon fiber shoe doesn't bend, your foot has to bend. And your foot may bend in a place where it doesn't have an axis. And biomechanically, if the axis is different where the fulcrum is on the shoe as to where your foot wants to bend, then things get stressed. And so what the carbon fiber shoes do is they get you up on your toes faster. So the transition time from heel or midfoot to toe is shorter and more rapid. And it may be too rapid for your soft tissue to adjust. And that's why some people tear their plantar fascia or get plantar fasciitis or posterior tibial tendon, which is your arch tendon. Or some people's bone gets stressed, and it can be in the midfoot, in the back of the metatarsals on the instep to the middle bones. And then the navicular is the weak bone. So that's why we were seeing more injuries there. So again, just to summarize, the carbon plate does not bend and your foot has to bend. So the weakest link will break.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. And so when you have, you wrote this case series together with some colleagues, can you explain a little bit the types of injuries and cases that you discuss in the case series? What type of athletes and how did their injuries come about in terms of acute versus stress over time and so on?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of the patients had them acutely. They were high level elite athletes that don't train normally in carbon fiber footwear, and one needed surgery, one did not, and then there were three youth athletes in track and field also had the commonality, a couple of them in steeplechase, where you're landing on your ball, your foot, and that puts more impact into the navicular. And one of them ended up having surgery. Surgery, again, for type 2 and 3 is more predictable. And if just statistically in my series in 2017, if you did not have surgery and you had a type 3 under age 19, you're statistically more likely to fracture, get arthritis, or give up your sport. So again, it's a significant injury. And parents sometimes freak out if you tell them, you know, their 16 or 17 year old needs surgery. It can happen, but again, the arthritis is a tough thing to deal with that foot. There's no joint replacement in that joint. I've done several times an arthrodiastasis. That's what I did on Paula Ratcliffe, the former marathon record holder, where you stretch out the joint to try to let soft tissue fill in. And she's still able to run 40 miles a week, and she likes the carbon fiber shoes. I think that's they are comfortable for some people. You just need to make sure that your foot has enough mobility that it bends where the shoe is forcing your foot to bend.
Hmm. In the athletes in the case series, is it fair to say that all of them had relatively limited experience with the carbon fiber shoes? So and that would point towards a safe transition into using them would be just gradually building volume, and you maybe not using them for the first time in a race or something. Or what would the
exactly, yes,
key take-home message be?
Definitely don't use them for a first time. Well, there's the rookie mistakes, right? So don't use them for the first time in a race. You shouldn't be doing that anyway. There were some instances of that in our Olympic marathon trials in 2020 in U.S., with injuries. So you want to do some gradual transitioning. The other thing is that there's a helpful device. I don't have any ownership or anything. You can, it's called the Blackboard, and there's a website, blackboardtraining.com. And I believe there's a hyphen between Blackboard and training. And I have links on my website. My website, by the way, is just my name and as one word, amalsuxena.com. Got a nice picture of Chelsea, who won the Ironman this year. She's been a long-term patient. But if you go under links, you can get this Blackboard. And again, I don't have any ownership in it. It's just a hinge type of device that you can change and work your foot in multiple planes. So that helps mobilize and work your foot in multiple different axes to get your foot stronger and more mobile. And so I think that's a helpful thing. And it's a popular device with a lot of physios in Europe. I've brought the technology, so to speak, and the concepts to the United States. So I have several physical therapists, and there's some courses that are being done that are often taught by Europeans. And so I would consider getting that type of device or some type of foot mobilization device. You can start out with those ankle balls, which make your foot bend, and try to mobilize and strengthen your foot as you start adopting to the carbon fiber shoes.
Yeah, and that will probably be helpful anyway, whether you're using carbon fiber shoes or not, because injuries could be prevented by better foot mobility and strength.
Yeah, it's a game changer for athletes and dancers. It's great. So.
Yeah. There's one that I know called the Mobo Board by physiotherapist Jay Dishari as well. I think it's kind of a
similar. Yeah, that's principle. Another good thing. Yeah.
Another point that you raise in the article is just increasing the awareness around this potential danger, I guess, of navicular stress injuries from using carbon fiber footwear, especially if you rush into the transition. So I guess that's now something that we're trying to do here in this podcast as well, making sure that athletes are aware that if they have something that feels the symptoms feel like what you described, then that's something that they can consider when they go to their doctor. But is there anything else that you would say on that point, on the raising awareness point about navicular injuries?
Well, it's a little bit of a complicated issue with shoe companies obviously needing to and selling shoes and the public wanting to run faster. And I think that doctors need to know about footwear just like they need to know about medication, particularly podiatrists and other sports medicine doctors. So that's why we try to publish. We wrote a letter to the editor in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, actually. It takes a long time to get these things published and collected. I mean, we started working on this paper over a year. And, you know, if you go to meetings, you might hear a little bit about this. And so I think it takes time and the motivation for awareness in this aspect. Maybe a little bit have a conflict, so to say.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. Shoe companies have in the past used reduced injury risk as a marketing tool, but they're probably unlikely to have any warnings around potential increased injury risks when you transition to a different type of footwear. Is there anything else that we should mention regarding these injuries or this carbon fiber footwear that we have missed?
No, I think we covered. I think, summarize, before you start running in carbon fiber footwear, start strengthening and mobilizing your foot. Do it gradually. I don't know necessarily if you have to follow the 10% rule. I don't necessarily think you need to. But I do think you need to do shorter runs before longer runs and don't do them first time in a race. And top of the foot or instep pain can be a slow healing stress fracture. So if you have throbbing, aching, hurts to go up on your toes, gets worse as you run, then you need to push for a proper examination. And keep in mind, the average navicular stress fracture in the medical community takes 9 months to diagnose. So you may need to push a little harder, and a CT scan is definitely the best test. It's better than an MRI. It does have radiation, but it's very low. And then you may need surgery for the navicular injuries. And so you need to realize that. I see time and time again, people treated non-surgically for months, and it takes away their particularly a high school kid, takes away their whole year of school or sports. Because if it takes 4.5 months to get back to sport after surgery, that's a half a year.
Yeah, and that's a perfect summary. And just one point there with the transition into gradually using the carbon fiber shoes. A couple of the case studies included were basically track and field athletes, I think, doing an interval workout for the first time in the shoes. So maybe if we're a bit more specific, it might make sense to start with some shorter, easier runs. And then maybe when you start doing intensity, even not using the shoes for all of your intervals, if you have a workout that is, whatever it is, 6 times 1K, then maybe do 3 of them in the carbon fiber shoes rather than all 6 of them.
That's awesome. That would be a good way to do it.
Yeah. All right. So let's just finish off with the rapid fire questions that I ask all guests on the podcast. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
You know, I still go back to Jack Daniel's distance running formula from 1998. I've been coaching since I was in seventh grade. I've coached different levels, including helping elite athletes, getting them back when they've been injured or have surgery. And so I look at that. There's a new book by Mark Coogan. I'm looking forward to getting my autograph copy. And Brian Fulham, another sports podiatrist, has a good book on foot and ankle injuries, knowing your foot and ankle. So there's a lot of good resources. The Joel Friel's training, triathlete's Bible, that's another one, because I transitioned from marathon running to duathlon. I've competed in several worlds in the duathlon. So there's a lot of good books out there.
And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Well, it goes with everything. I used to say anticipation is the key to relaxation, but my wife updated and said preparation is the key to relaxation. So I think you need to be prepared, anticipate. You need to learn how to manage time. And, people are down playing the importance of multitasking. Multitasking is an important skill that every mother probably has who said, I only have two hands. So I think in athletics, in your profession, and personally, you need to learn how to juggle. And it's not a bad thing to be a good multitasker.
And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Well, Mahatma Gandhi, be the change. I've tried to be positive about and influence people positively in my field and research. And, Martin Luther King has a lot of great sayings as well. I'm currently doing a master's in public health through the Dartmouth Institute, Dartmouth College. And, I think it's important to keep learning and look at self-analysis and look at your outcomes as if you're a practitioner. That's very important. That's why Adam 1040 and I bond quite well. And a lot of my other colleagues I publish with, because we like to look at our outcomes and help other people be better practitioners.
Right. This has been fantastic, Amol. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your knowledge. I really appreciate it. And I hope that it can be really useful for the listeners to hopefully prevent a lot of injuries. And if they have them, basically treat them the best way that they can. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thanks. And my website has a lot of information that's helpful, exercises and things on injuries. It's just amolsaxena.com. So my name is one word. amolsaxena.com.
Yeah, I'll put the link to that and all the relevant links in the show notes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. I hope that you enjoyed these interviews. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Dustin's and Amol's websites, Dustin's Instagram, the studies that we discussed in these interviews, as well as the previous episode that I did with Dr. Schubert about the original Super Shoe study that he conducted. Next Monday, I interview Dajo Sanders, who is a coach at Ineos Grenadiers and a sports scientist who has done a lot of really interesting research in the world of cycling. So that will be an interesting interview with a mix of training and practical application, as well as some science and physiology baked in. So stay tuned for that. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or training plan. We have options for athletes of all different levels and different budgets, and no matter the size of your goal. A few points to highlight that reduce the barrier to get started is that we have no minimum commitment term nor any startup fees for coaching. And for training plans, we have a 100% satisfaction guarantee for plans purchased on our website and an exchange guarantee, so you can exchange your plan for another plan if you purchase it through Training Peaks. We also have consultation and customized plan options for something in between. So you can find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs, and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. And use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goals. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.